It's The Wonky Show. Scotland has been topping up on crisis support. We'll get across the detail. And we're live in London for our Secret Life of Students event. There's highlights, clips and reflections from our guests. It's all coming up.
All the crisis and pressure that's around us. The degree of autonomy that the higher education sector has, particularly if you've worked in schools, which is mind-blowing. There are so many possibilities in that space that you can grab hold of.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and as I say, recording live over lunchtime at our Secret Life of Students event here in London. Here to reflect on all of that that's been going on, as usual, three terrific guests. Gigi Alamo is president at the University of Bath Students Union. Gigi, your highlight of the day, please.
There's been a lot, but I think Liam, who's the president at the SU Surrey, his story was really impressive. And I especially like when he said, you know, sometimes you have to accept that you're in pain, but not accept that it's okay that you're in pain. And I found that really, really good.
And that bit was actually off script. So yeah, we'll edit that in a minute. Mark Peace is Professor of Innovation in Education at King's College London. Mark, your highlight of the day, please.
So my highlight of the day was reading the agenda and getting really exciting and arriving with Avanti West Coast getting me here 5 minutes early, which means it set me up with the hope that if Avanti can get me here 5 minutes early, anything is possible.
All with working Wi-Fi, extraordinary. And Debbie McVitie is editor at Wonky. Debbie, your highlight of the day, please.
Well, we've clearly had some cracking sessions, but since every single one of you were the ones kind of the architects of those sessions on the stage, I'm going to not suck up and say that the thing I'm looking forward to about the day is later when we talk about all the kind of things that institutions might need to do and think about and become in order to start building the kind of future that we want to see.
Excellent stuff. So yes, we start this week with Scotland. On Friday evening, the Scottish Government announced an additional £10 million in sustainability support for universities. Debbie, what's going on?
Well, I mean, I think we like to say in the English context that there's a higher education funding crisis. I think Scotland has known about this for a very, very long time. Obviously, the unit of resource that comes into Scottish institutions for Scottish students comes directly from the government. That unit of resource is significantly lower than for rest of UK students. And as a consequence, Scottish higher education has been in a funding crisis for a very, very long time. This has come to a head over the last couple of weeks, particularly at the University of Dundee, but by no means limited to that university. But at Dundee specifically, there's been headlines with a loss of 600 staff and sort of, you know, really, really, really serious institutional challenges. The Scottish Government had a couple of weeks ago announced £15 million in bridging loans to support the sector more generally. And then, of course, as Jim, as you just said, on Friday evening, there's been an announcement of an additional £10 million. So I think what we're seeing here is the real kind of, this is the moment where, you know, the rubber meets the road in terms of kind of addressing university financial sustainability and seeing how what governments do when institutions get into this kind of situation.
Yes, well, fascinating stuff. Now, Education Secretary Jenny Gilruth was on the Sunday show. That's the Scottish version of that thing that's on after Koonsberg on a Sunday, depending on where you live. Here's a clip.
We do need to be mindful, though, that the issues in relation to Dundee University are quite unique. Those relate to alleged financial mismanagement and are not in any way related to issues regarding tuition fees, which I appreciate you've been discussing this morning.
We don't have Dundee Uni on to answer those suggestions. But look, what I will say to you is that we know that I think the running costs of Edinburgh University at the moment, just kind of keeping the lights on, keep the labs running, are something like £120 million a month. I mean, they would run through that £10 million cheque you're writing in 2.5 days.
Absolutely. Our universities are facing an inordinate amount of challenge, but that's not a unique situation to Scotland, Martin. I mean, if you look across the United Kingdom, Cardiff, Durham, Newcastle, all considering substantial cuts to their workforce as a result of inflationary pressures. You've heard about some of the challenge in that respect this morning. Also the implication of national insurance contributions. So we know that University Scotland have forecast that that's going to cost universities in Scotland up to £45 million. So there is action that's been taken by the Scottish Government, but I do have to reflect that there is action being taken elsewhere that's making that job all the more difficult.
Mark, does that stack up, do you think?
It's very convenient, isn't it? And maybe it's reassuring. There's a comforting emperor's new clothes around it. We know, of course, that it isn't. We know, of course, that it's a signal of crisis beyond the sector that is felt harder in Scotland than it is elsewhere in the UK. And whilst the things that may have led to Dundee's particular precarity at the moment may be unique, the foundations that sit underneath that are in no ways unique, and it's a signal of something much broader in the sector, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting stuff, this, isn't it, Gigi? Because obviously, lots of the conversation, particularly politically, and we've seen this in Wales too, and to some extent in England, is about the precarity of the institutions. But on the scale of the cuts that are now being proposed at Dundee, you would ask questions, wouldn't you, about what sort of student experience will be left at the back of that?
Yeah, and I think even before cuts were announced in Dundee and in other institutions, which obviously, you know, however you want to say Dundee is unique. Obviously, other institutions have already announced this kind of the cuts as well. You're already seeing kind of, I'd say, like the student to staff ratio in universities completely change. And then, you know, students reporting, I don't even get to see my dissertation supervisor more than once in the whole year. So in the like grand scheme of things, I don't think it's that hard to challenge that, you know, there won't be much of a student experience compared to what the expectations of certainly our current students are in terms of their engagement with, say, staff. But even if you want to talk about more literal terms, if you come into a lecture hall and there isn't space for you to sit because the university, you know, kind of over recruited so they can make some ends meet, that is obviously just going to make it even worse.
Jenny continued, so there was some quite interesting questioning on whether taxpayers should fund university education for want of a better phrase, posh kids. Let's hear another clip.
If a kid goes to Fettes in Edinburgh, that child's parents are paying £33,000 a year for its education, and then that child does well at Fettes, wants to go to St Andrews, you're saying, okay, the taxpayer will pick up the tab for that. Well, why?
Martin, our policy in relation to free tuition is well understood by the Scottish people, and we don't go back on our promises in relation to this. You may look at the Labour Party, of course, when they were elected in the 90s, gave great promises in relation to free tuition and reneged on them. We've been very clear in our policy position on this over the course of a number of years. Free tuition is a policy we will stand by, and we must be very careful not to conflate what's happening in one institution at the current time, and I accept there are challenges in others, to be in any way an argument to reintroduce tuition fees. You know, the next generation should not have to incur the debt on their backs because of decisions taken prior to their time.
£900 million a year this policy costs you. Imagine what you could do with that money. It's five times the amount you pay every year for trying to narrow the attainment gap.
Look, Martin, we're not going to have to agree to disagree in relation to tuition fees, because of course the SNP has a policy position on that, which is quite...
It's going to 100% you guarantee it'll be in your manifesto next
week. We know.
Free universal tuition fees.
We know. Absolutely, the SNP has always been committed to a policy of free tuition. This is not a change in tack from us, but what we are seeing, I suspect, is a movement from some to use the incident at Dundee University in some way to justify reintroducing tuition fees. That's not a position we can credibly stand by, because we know, as in the case of Dundee University, tuition fees has not been the major factor at play here.
Okay.
So we need to be very careful.
But you could generate yourself a little bit more hedge.
So this, of course, you know, for lots of people, Debbie, re-raises the opportunity to raise the question about free education in Scotland, doesn't it?
Yes, and the Scottish government, the SNP has sort of said on a number of occasions, loudly and consistently, that Scottish education should always be free to Scottish students, and there should be no tuition fee. I think that and of course, you know, the counter argument is that one of the things that the fee does elsewhere in the UK is redistribute costs from away from those who are less advantaged, unless they kind of subsequently go on to make pots of money and can afford to pay it back. So it's still free at the point of use in tuition fee terms, if not in maintenance terms. If you don't then make the economic returns, then you don't have to pay it back. So I think the kind of one of the things that, you know, when we talk to Scottish colleagues, is I think there's a sort of sense of despair at the debate is very one-dimensional. It's not, you know, it's not very nuanced. It's not very thoughtful. And there is this kind of sense of, we need to set rich kids off against poor kids. When actually the consequence of the system as it's configured is about the kind of principle of free education, not about the realities of how do you expand access, make higher education accessible and make it something that everyone can take part in.
Mark, I often think when I'm thinking about this that, I mean, for a start, of course, all sorts of types of higher education in Scotland, even for Scottish students, aren't free, right? Postgraduate, you know, all sorts of stuff. But and you know, you think about international students and so on. But of course, you know, their living costs aren't free. They're taking out debt for those. There are all sorts of. Why is it, do you think, that the SNP just has this totemic tuition for undergraduate students from Scotland? Why is it that is so totemic that is preventing a sort of more sophisticated conversation that Debbie suggests?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's more than just the maintenance issue, isn't it? It's the value of your education as well. So there's three components going on. There's the perceived cost to you in your pocket, which is the fee. There is all of those auxiliary costs, which are really, really significant, that enable you to actually engage with that or not. And we've talked lots today about the ways in which the need to have to work to top up maintenance erodes your capacity to take the value out of your education that's there. Yeah. But then there's actually the unit of resource to universities and how much value they can give you in that education. And I think the thing about the fee is it speaks directly in everyday terms to the person on the street. I understand I pay this.
Yeah.
All of these other things are hidden and complex and really difficult to translate in policy terms to an end user, but are actually, I think, probably far more significant in terms of what you get out of an education.
Yeah. GT, let me ask you this question. So I've got this sort of theory off the back of talking to people over the past few years, which is everyone sort of gets there's all sorts of cross subsidies, right? Like some people use the sports facilities, some people don't. You know, some people will need mental health support 1 month, some people won't. But is there a point from a student perspective where the level of cross subsidy, say from international students to home students, is so big that that stops being accepted and starts being resented?
Not only am I an international student, but I study politics, which is obviously a humanities course, which in turn is then subsidizing the, you know, the pharmacy and stuff student. So, I mean,
many thanks.
So clearly, at least, you know, for me, it you know, led me to run for officer. And I was like, well, you know, if I'm going to be paying this amount of money, then, you know, the university management team are going to hear about it. So there is definitely a breaking point, I guess. But and equally, in a way, we recently had a bit of an issue at our university where current international students that were doing a master's were being contacted by people from their countries on LinkedIn, asking them, how is your university? Is it worth going to? And they were saying, absolutely not. I'm paying too much money for the experience that I'm getting. And it wasn't until we brought this up with the senior team at the university that they said, maybe we were going to have to do things differently. And it's obviously, you know, it only started to become a sort of conversation leading to hopefully some change when the institutions were going to see the backlash. But it wasn't until that point, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I do think there's something really kind of challenge. I mean, if we could admire the problem a lot in this kind of face, can we? You know, it's like, oh, it's very, very, it's very complicated, isn't it? But as the UK delivery kind of envelope shrinks because of inflation, because of government, you know, choices and so on, you know, that bit of the system, it doesn't, you know, you can, there's lots of things you could do to make that bit cheaper. You could do that, you know, you would probably have to compromise on quality and experience and all the rest of it, but you could cut services, you could, you know, cut contact, there's lots of things you could do. The problem is that that would then make the very thing that you're trying to sell internationally less desirable. And so actually, and you know, and so you get that kind of sort of sustainability problem where you have to continue to present something in the international market that looks like a kind of full fat student experience, because that's what international students will pay for, at the same time as a sort of not really delivering that. So then you get that sort of, you know, the sort of unhappy outcome.
Mark, I guess one of the other things that I often think about is, you know, I mean, there are a lot of players here. I mean, in particularly in Scotland, we've got the complexity of education is reserved, is devolved, and immigration isn't. And of course, what that does is that gives Jenny Gilruth at least the opportunity of an escape route in an interview. But an escape route in an interview isn't kind of coordinated strategy, is it? And it just feels like a lot of the time, lots of bits of government are throwing stuff at each other, either in Westminster or between nations and so on. And actually what we probably need is everyone just to get in a room and say, this is how we fund higher education, or this is at least the extent to which we can fund higher education from the taxpayer. Is that too optimistic?
Well, it's not if you say it like that. common sense, isn't it? I think it's been well exercised in your stables around the ways in which higher education is pulled across different portfolios. And some of that is responsibility for different bits. You know, we've talked about, you know, planning for accommodation being separate from planning for education. But the actual core product of higher education isn't owned by one mandate. It's education and it's innovation and it's business and it's all of those different things. So it comes apart at the seams really, really easily. And I think that it's less, can we come together in a coordinated way? And how do you sustain a coordinated conversation without it coming apart at the seams and into the different portfolios of government is the real challenge.
And then just finally, Debbie, I guess Gilruth's position is Dundee is separate, different, not systemic. What would it take to really force a debate here? Is it two universities in Dundee's position? You know, what is it that gets it out of the, it's just a one-off this? Mm. Over-recruited in Nigerian students, I think she said in another part of the interview.
I think, well, I suppose you can either have another institution getting into a Dundee-style situation. As Gigi said, this Dundee is not the first university in Scotland to be posting notice of major redundancies, you know. So you can either have a sort of domino collapse thing, or you can have sort of straws in the wind and the kind of groundswell of public opinion. And I think this is, I suppose optimally what you have is you have this is something that University of Scotland is thinking really, really hard about. How can we have a better conversation about this? That's not about fees or no fees. That's about saying, what are the things that we're kind of willing to fund? What are the things that need to be funded? What are the compromises that we need to make in order to be sustainable? And to make that a sort of open public conversation rather than something that is kind of negotiated from the wrong end of a public funding rifle, you know? Yeah. And I think that's where, you know, it is, we can only hope that that conversation emerges in light of some of these crises, and it doesn't take more crisis to get to that point where it needs to be. I think Jenny Gilruth probably in her heart of hearts knows that she needs to get there.
Right. Fantastic stuff. Plenty more on the site about all of that. Now, live from London, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
I'm Emma Maslin, Senior Policy and Research Officer at MOSHI, the Student Services Organisation. My blog is part of the Wonky Commute Student Series, which draws on my PhD research on commuter student experiences in the north of England. In my article, I suggest that we need to think differently about commuter students, although being mindful that they're not all the same with differing experiences and perspectives. Specifically, that being a commuter student is not mutually exclusive to having a poor student experience. Students may not want to live in student accommodation, they may regularly participate in extracurricular activities, or they may simply see their commute as just what you do for working life. I argue we need to instead consider how institutions can enhance commuter students' experiences during their studies, including reassessing how their policies and practices meet the needs of the student group.
Now, we've been here at The Secret Life of Students today, where I kicked off the event with some thoughts on what should be in a new vision for being a full-time student. And then a panel of experts took it apart. Let's have a listen. Doing better and getting better is also partly about time. It's the most precious resource because you can't get it back. Student disengagement isn't about apathy, it's about time poverty. As costs rise, students work more hours, they commute longer distances, and traditional timetables become impossible. Attendance drops, not from lack of interest, but simple maths. There are not enough hours in the day or week. When you're first in your family to go to university, you get your impression of what it'll be like off the telly. And so when I see photos of empty lecture theatres on social media, I think of the 1985 Val Kilmer classic, Real Genius. And there's a brilliant bit near the start. In the first lecture, there's a packed room full of eager students. In the second lecture, it's half empty and some students have been replaced by big tape recorders. By the final lecture of term, the room is completely completely empty with a note on the chalkboard that says, math is hard to follow. It's funny because it's true. Students have always looked for efficiency, but maybe today's empty seats are less about efficiency and more about necessity. The research tells us an alarming story. Students working over 15 hours weekly are 65% more likely to feel like they don't belong, 47% more likely to feel lonely, 71% more likely to consider dropping out. They're not just numbers, they're real students torn between paying rent and getting an education. When most full-time students have to work to survive, commute farther because of housing costs, or juggle family duties alongside study, most structures don't fit their reality. But back at the ranch, the approach to timetabling, assessment deadlines, and attendance policies all often assume that students have much more free time than they really do. Block teaching offers an interesting alternative. Bursts of intense learning can work. Hopefully, that is what you will be saying in the feedback form on the way home. But whatever the solution, the challenge isn't to complain about changing student behaviour, but to adapt our structures to their economic and social reality. When we blame students for only doing the minimum, we miss the point. The issue isn't about motivation, it's the basic constraints of time and money that shape their choices. So here's an approach. We should formally recognise the time students spend contributing to their student and local communities by formally recognising it in the credit framework. Imagine if one of the things that British HE was famous for was that all undergraduate students had the opportunity to learn 10 ECTS credits annually, PGT 15, we'll work it out for PGRs, through structured contributions to other students, to the university, or to the wider community, or even to the CSR of local employers. Extracurricular, but not extra to the degree. When a student mentors first years through the transition to university, they're developing teaching and leadership skills while reducing isolation amongst newcomers. When students create cultural societies that connect international students with local communities, they're building intercultural competence while strengthening civic relationships. When students take part in a case competition, solving problems for local firms, they're gaining practical experience while creating tangible value for community partners. It all becomes reinforcing. Students receive formal academic recognition for their contribution that legitimizes the time they spend on activities beyond their coursework. Students can engage meaningfully without guilt or anxiety, and their contributions enhance the community while developing key competencies. When financial necessity requires a more efficient Mass HE system, and it requires students to work substantial hours alongside study, they face difficult trade-offs between earning, learning, and contributing. But if we integrate learning, work, and service, not all into the curriculum, but some into the credit system, we give them time to make what might otherwise be seen as a distraction or a luxury into a recognised component of their higher education. We also heard from Sanam Arora, founder and chairperson of the National Indian Students and Alumni Union UK, on some of the things you can't say in HE.
I think the number one thing is around employability. We've conducted a ton of research in the past. We know it from our daily lived experiences with Indian students that the number one reason majority of Indian students would consider studying abroad, certainly in the UK, is this expectation that there will be some employability outcomes. That doesn't necessarily 100% translate into I expect a job, but what it does mean is that I will become globally employable and I'll have the opportunity to secure meaningful work experience after I've completed studies. And that is why the graduate route, 2 to 3 year graduate route, is so important. Yeah. But in that regard, what is now happening, and in fact, we conducted a survey led by QS and UUK, where we found that, I think they surveyed about 10,000 recent international graduates from the UK. And it was found that only 3% of international graduates are actually finding jobs through their career services. 3%. Now, I know that this situation is not the most optimal, but 3% is pretty low. And that just sheds light on this entire question of return on investment. Like, when I put a pound into a mutual fund in the UK, if, as a British taxpayer, or as a British investor, I get a detail like 30-page value for money report mandatorily because the Financial Conduct Authority makes sure that I get that value for money report. How did the quid I spent do? Where did my money go? How far did it go? Well, here's students who are spending 30, 40, 50, 60, 70,000 pounds into their education in our country over a period of just, let's say, a year. They're right to expect certain metrics of ROI. And if one of those critical metrics is employability, and you're telling me only 3% are actually landing jobs through their career services, something is missing. So I think one, and this is really contributing to very bad optics for Indian prospective students who are thinking about study destinations, because studying is not equal to sitting in a classroom and listening. Studying is equal to gaining the opportunity also to gain meaningful work experience. Again, I insist, not equal to employment, but equal to employability, which includes real work experience. And so in that regard, employability is a major issue.
And then just before lunch, a panel of student union officers and staff set out their thinking on getting to a better student experience.
On ethics and values, students want to study a university that considers its position in the world, engages with its legacies and considers its impact, and to feel part of a collective voice that can advocate for the support the student community needs. On campus spaces, students want spaces that are sustainable and fit for purpose, and spaces developed with feedback, collaboration, and accessibility at the forefront. Each set of these visions are purposefully broad. We want them to be flexible to ever-changing student ideas what good might look like, while still being rigid enough as kind of a mechanism for change. Together, what they do is that they tell the university and the sector what the future for students ought to be across the six priorities. With their supporting evidence base, these also constitute, or we hope that they do, a resource bank on the one hand, but also essentially a campaigning platform where members can identify common concerns and interests and build relationships with other groups. Academic reps, for example, have told us that their agenda helps them address common goals and support their advocacy on faculty levels.
And I love to see how the culture is now changing, where students are becoming more aware, or they want to hold people accountable. They want to hold the university accountable. They want to hold the union accountable. If we are promising something to the students, we must ensure that we're delivering that. And whilst we're talking about that, whilst we're talking about students, I think this might not actually land very well in this room, but just be honest with yourselves for a second. How many times have you actually seen in your institution where students, where you were told we were going to do something, we're going to consult the students just as a text box exercise? Have you seen, heard, or anything? You don't actually talk about student experience, or you don't actually talk about what students want, or you don't always necessarily consult them. And that's not what students are asking for.
So, Mark, lots in there. One of the things I guess we've spent quite a bit of time talking about, it came upon, we've been running a Discord server today, how modern, has been time. You know, a lot of this, you know, one of the things I was trying to talk quite a bit about was time.
So, yeah. So I think that the notion of time as kind of currency, I think you talked about it being precious because you can't take it back. You can't earn it back. You can't get more of it from somewhere else. So it becomes the end point game of how you shape your student experience. And I think one of the things that has resonated with me is the tensions between the ways that universities would like to make demands on student time and the very old-fashioned normative expectations that sit underneath how a student can spend their time,
yeah,
and the increasing realities of how students have to invest that time. And I think for me, a thought to take away is just the possibility of some better resonance in that space, which feels entirely doable, actually. It feels like one of those things that we could just sit down sensibly and reset and find a way around.
Yeah. I mean, Gigi, let me ask you this question. I mean, do you think the problem is that people don't really understand just how busy lots of students are? Or is it that people know and it's just that this is a hard science problem? You know, I mean, timetabling is not straightforward. You know, I mean, is it the thing I was talking about this morning where, you know, people, as far as I was concerned, weren't really thinking about how students would spend their week during COVID? Or is it that people know and it's just so hard to make changes to these really big you know, structural questions in terms of how the sector's run?
I think it's a combination of the two, if I'm honest. I think the sector as a whole and institutions specifically realize that there's an issue, but I don't think they realize the magnitude of it. And obviously, if you're not the student that has to run from having a 12-hour shift in a hospitality venue somewhere in town to get to campus for a lecture at 4:15 to then go to a seminar across campus 2 hours later, and then you can't get on a bus, or, you know, maybe you don't have enough money in your bank account and you can't pay for the bus, and then you have to walk up, at least in Bath, a massive hill. Until you are that student, it's really hard to feel and understand the magnitude of that and of that problem. And I think quite frankly, for me, it's a flexibility issue, really, because, you know, lecturers say, well, my students have to be in the lecture hall and they have to be here, and I take attendance, and in order to pass my unit, then that's a requirement. But then obviously students say, well, if it's between passing this unit and then being able to pay rent, well, I'm not going to pass this unit. But then obviously the system in itself doesn't allow for that. Well, okay, you didn't pass this unit. What does the wider implications on that and your ability to then get a degree is, in my opinion, way bigger than it should be. Yeah. And there isn't any sort of flexibility to that kind of personal adjustment.
Debbie, in the sort of government policy space, obviously, in theory, fairly soon, the government, at least the Westminster government, has to make a decision about whether under the LLE to take a quarter of what we currently think of as a undergraduate year and allocate a quarter of the maintenance loan to that period. You know, there are big questions coming, aren't there, about whether or not we stick to this idea that, in theory, what you do is you get your degree done in 3 years.
Mm. Yeah, and I think what... Well, do you remember when the last government announced the LLE and everyone said, that's a jolly good idea? Because obviously it's a great idea, isn't it? If you want to do your degree in 2 years, you can do that. If you want to do your degree in 4 years, you can do that. You just stack it up and you take, you know, and you step off and you come back. And this is, you know, this is the dream. This is what should be happening, or should be able to happen. And of course, if you want to have that kind of sort of fairly sort of straightforward, you know, stack it up, take a long summer break, stack it up and so on, you can do that too. I think it's going to take quite a long time to get to the point where that is what is happening. But I think one of the things, and I think that inevitably, you know, the way that the LLE has been designed is it's kind of like an answer to the question that wasn't asked. You know, what you would hope would happen would be there would be a sort of vision for the future that is of a sort of lifelong learning model that is thought through in terms of what that student experience ought to look like. And you then put the funding in underneath to support that. We've got it the other way around. Let's create the funding and then sort of see what happens. That does, I think, create opportunities to, you know, try things out. But it's also very clear that you don't just create the system and go, ta-na, and then everyone starts sort of suddenly adapting. The enormous cultural weight of the 3-year full-time model is, you know, it's absolutely vast. So yes, you can change the incentives, but then it's got to evolve. There's got to be some kind of thinking around that. But I do feel moderately optimistic about that, actually. I think some universities will decide, no, that's not what we're doing. We are this kind of university and we deliver this kind of experience, and that's fine, because if that's what students want, they can go to that. And other universities will use the flexibility afforded them if they can get their systems to kind of make that work. Yeah. And, you know, to do that, and we'll kind of end up in a better place. I just think it's going to take a very long than it probably needs to, had there been a bit more of a vision stitched around it in the first place.
I guess the other thing that has come up a few times this morning, Mark, has been, obviously one of the things I was effectively saying was, I think what AI does is make lots of what's currently in a lot of academic subjects slightly less important, only slightly, slightly less important, slightly easier to do, and slightly less necessary in the volumes that we do it. And I think what that does is create space, potentially in the credit system, for recognising some of the things that we regard as a luxury as being educational and therefore worthy of time. Now, that presents real challenges, doesn't it? Because quite necessarily, people are deliberately very proud and precious of the kind of body of knowledge that they think they're perhaps teaching or transmitting in an academic course.
So I think challenges, but also opportunities. So I think let's not understate how exciting that space could be. because it squares lots of these conversations. I mean, one of the tensions around time is, you know, we want students to spend time on the thing we want them to do. There's a kind of relaxation that that brings with us, that actually we can let some of the things that happen in university spaces be legitimate learning gains. So, you know, you can, all of those other competing demands, they're part of actually a quite old-fashioned, we come to university to find ourselves and to become, and we find new ways of revisiting that. Actually, why don't we let that be? And maybe some of the space that this creates lets us do that. You're absolutely right, though, that it's a really hard thing to lead in a university. It's not to say that people aren't already doing it. There are places where there is really exciting practice in the credit system that is enabling those things to happen. But I think there's often a tension in universities that people see their bit.
Yeah.
And they've been grown, universities have been grown up around the notion of an individual's expertise. So then the idea that we could let go of that bit of the universe, fine if it's their bit, but if it's my bit, that's quite difficult because I get all of my identity out of that. So there's a social compact both with students and staff that needs to be navigated really, really carefully if that's what we're going to achieve. But hopefully you can do it by also giving that space to staff. You know, you are also not now bound by the same really rigid credit framework that means if you wanted to do that thing, you've got to wait 3 years to get this thing validated. To get about by, you've lost, it's not relevant and you've lost interest in it. You can just do it now in a much more relaxed, flexible system.
Yeah. I guess, Gigi, the other thing that, and I've had a few conversations about this with people throughout the day is, you know, students won't do lots of this stuff that you say they will do. And I can't work out whether, you know, that part of my theory is that when students sort of arrive at university, they learn the rules very quickly. They learn the social norms. And it's not that they'll do what they're told, but they will do what other students are doing, partly because they want to fit in and that's what they, you know, they're told success is like. But am I wrong? Is it that students aren't very community minded? Is it that students are less wanting to give of their time to others? Or is it about the way we introduce them to those sorts of kind of community building activities rather than just the stuff that builds their own competence and skill and value?
I mean, I think the honest answer is, and I'm obviously generalizing here, but I think any student that comes to university comes with the expectation of, or at least the hope of building a community and belonging to something, because otherwise the whole experience would be, you know, very lonely and by extension hard to, I guess, get through, especially if you have to do it in 3 years, or maybe perhaps even longer. But I think it is more about, and I guess going back to Mark's point in terms of, you know, when you allow that flexibility for both staff and students in terms of what that engagement looks like and not necessarily forcing them down, this is what your experience has to be like and this is what success looks like. And if you're not part of a society and if you're not, you know, part of a sport and if you don't get a first or a 2-1 in your degree, then you failed. I think there's a lot of on the weight that we put on students because of the language that we currently use and because of that whole made up ideal student experience that I guess in a way is setting a lot of them for failure.
Now, Debbie, Gigi mentioned the first 2-1 thing. I think the phrase I used was the degree classification system represents everything we're not. It needs to be abolished now. There have been several runs at this before. I mean, my case is what first 2-1s and so on does is pretend that there is a result of appearing somewhere in a pecking order. And actually what we need in a mass system is for that piece of paper to tell the world what it is that's good about and special about you. Now, is that just utopian twaddle?
I mean, I have long walked around the sector casually saying, well, this should just be pass-fail. because at the end of the day, you know, did you reach the standard or didn't you? That's, you know, and then beyond that, it's about, well, what have you done? What can you bring? And, you know, and I think a lot of educators kind of agree and lots of really interesting experiments going on actually about trying to say, well, how do we bake some of that thinking, particularly when students are transitioning into higher education, when they actually need to do a lot of unlearning in terms of that thing about, like, I'm the educator, I decide whether you're any good or not, and you have no agency or power in the situation at all. What you want and what you're interested in and what matters to you is not relevant here. It's all about, you know, what I've decided. That dynamic is you know, and you take that into the workplace, and that's just a terrible recipe for kind of thriving in the world, right? You know, you've got to find your way and your path and your strengths and your stuff that you care about, right? And higher education can be a great space to do that in. I do think, and I think there's a bigger question here about all of the things that we've talked about this morning, and we do, I mean, we're in the seventh year of The Secret Life of Students, and we do get up here and we do talk about utopian visions, and I think, and you know, we on the site this morning, Mark and I have a thing about kind of, well, how do we talk about possibility and ideas and utopia and sustain this idea that we can be hopeful even against a backdrop of really like quite challenging economic circumstances, shall we say? And how do people feel about how we do that? Because I think that, you know, that is a real challenge. You can do things in the policy space, which is about saying, what does a kind of small steps towards a bigger vision look like? And I think that's really important to do that and not just say, everyone should be over here and you're not doing it properly if you're not. But also you can't just sort of say, well, you know, there's no money and what are we supposed to do here? And I think what really kind of strikes me about what's going on in the sector right now is, and we see it, and I think we're going to talk about it a bit later as well, is, you know, everybody feels powerless. Everybody feels like they have a sense of what needs to change and absolutely no levers to change it. The government feels powerless to change higher education. Pro-vice chancellors feel powerless to kind of work with academics to change higher education. Students feel powerless to change higher education because they'll talk to the pro-vice chancellors, the pro-vice chancellors saying, what do you want me to do? These academics, they don't want to do it. Academics feel powerless because they can see what, you know, they work with the students and they can see what's going on, but they, you know, they're operating in this kind of system that feels completely detached from their lived experience. You know, there's got to be a better way to think about how these conversations happen in universities and how people kind of, there is power there. Of course there is. There's decision-making power. But I think it doesn't sit with any one individual or anywhere in the hierarchy. There's got to be some way of thinking about how do we have these conversations in a way that actually allows us to start walking along that journey towards this, you know, naive utopian ideal that we've articulated here at this brilliant event that we've attended, but now I feel really flat because we can't do any of it in our context.
I mean, it often feels to me like something has to give, right? Something has to give in order to just to give you the 5 minutes to kind of think or do and so on. And obviously we've talked today about how, you know, at least I can make an in-principle argument that a chunk of credit should not be owned by the academic subject. I think that might be one way of doing things from a student point of view. But I guess the other thing, Mark, is, you know, personally, I've been on quite a journey, right? I was one of those people that thought that exams were fine. And then I was one of those people that thought, actually, exams are terrible. We need to give people lots and lots of projects and essays and assignments to write. And yet all the student speakers we've had this morning have talked about over-assessment. That must be a problem in terms of grading those assessments. And, you know, two, is assessment, you know, tackling assessment a place where something could give?
Yeah, and I think there are many, many institutions who have taken hold of the notion that they may be over-assessing. I think that is very definitely a strand running through the sector right now, I think. But I think if you pull to the end of that strand, the need just to relax a little bit is really, really critical. I think that's the thing that starts to give us that space. And that's what's happening with assessment, of course, because assessment comes from, but we are the custodians of rigor and we can't be seen to be putting any of that down because we'll be dumbing down and we will be under attack. And that anxiety is very much there. And I've become very interested in the sector's collective psychic anxiety, because I think it's the same as any person under pressure. What happens is you retreat to your known narratives. That's what happens when you're in crisis, is you get to your scripts. I'm this and I'm that, and this is the way that things work. And I think I see in the sector a sense of that, of things can't change because we're under so much pressure. We have to keep hold of this knowable thing, whether it is the way we organize ourselves as a whole institution or my bit of this unit that I have to talk. It's the same collective sense of because I feel under threat, I need to hold on to something that feels secure. Yeah. And it just feels to me that if we could get to a point where we could let go of some of that, we'd be in a much nicer position, both with each other and with our students, to be able to take those next steps forward.
I mean, some of it, I guess, feels like, you know, there might need to be sort of moments or encounters where, you know, we sort of, you know, shake the tree a little little bit and you relax, think about things differently. I mean, Gigi, a few weeks ago, I made the journey along the M4, despite the fact that when I woke up, the M4 was closed. So that was a scary journey. Along the M4 to watch you launch your vision for the world's best student experience at the university. And I was sat at the back, so I couldn't see everyone's faces. And I was assuming you could, seeing a mixture of, I don't know, delight, horror. I mean, how has it sort of gone since you had the temerity, bravery, whatever it is, to sort of attempt one of those, shake the tree moments?
I think, well, first of all, the faces in the audience were, in fact, mostly, you know, delighted and happy. I feel I need to clarify. The horror has come after when we've seen the amount of work that it would actually mean for both us and the university. But I guess in a way for us, the whole journey has been leading to the conclusion, some of these changes really aren't as hard as we're saying they are for both us as student representatives and student leaders and the students, you know, doing student life. But for the institution as well, we're not saying you have to put a whole bunch of more money that is in there into these pots to fund some of this activity. It's more about, first of all, understanding that I think, again, it all comes down to the flexibility and that ability to step away from that crisis mode and say, you know, we can be looking at things differently and there might not be anything wrong with just maybe failing a bit and learning along the way and changing into something that is actually going to be a better experience. And I think for us as a union, we're in a far better position because we don't see other unions in the country as our competitors. We actually work alongside each other to lobby the national agenda together. And in a way that puts us in a very comfortable position to find out what everyone else is doing, where the pockets of excellence are, and we actually help each other grow. Whereas I think universities logically compete against each other for a number of reasons, but I guess that also puts them in an awkward position in that, you know, you have to be a lot more strategic about the way you spend your money and the way you spend your resource. And I think, honestly, they're just backing themselves into a corner.
And I think just for all the crisis and pressure that's around us, the degree of autonomy that the higher education sector has, particularly if you've worked in schools, which is where I cut my teeth, is mind-blowing. There are so many possibilities in that space that you can grab hold of. And I think it's sometimes hard to see those things.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Mark, Gigi, Debbie, Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.